Welcome to the Ask a Spiritual Director podcast, a podcast of question and exploration for all things related to the spiritual life and spirituality. I'm Samuel Ogles.
And I'm Kimberly Pelletier. Welcome to season three. Rather than exploring one question per episode, as we've done in the first two seasons, we're taking this entire season to explore one question in depth. And that question, what does healing look like in 2020? When Sam and I began considering this question, we realized that the depths of it could not even be explored in an episode. So you can look forward to 9 episodes over the next 3 months, leading us right up into Advent. We're going to start meta, and we're going to look at societal healing. And then we're going to move inward a little closer and look at interpersonal healing. And then finally, in the last 3 episodes, we'll move into individual healing. So those 3 segments are going to look like this. Political and ideological healing, faith community healing, racial healing. Then we're going to move on from that societal level and look at interpersonal healing. What does healing look like within marriage and partnership? What does healing look like within extended families? What does healing look like within friendships? And then we'll go into the personal level. What does healing look like in our mind, in our body, and in our soul? As an exciting and enriching new addition to season 3, we're also going to bring in some guests, and we're even going to offer some giveaways on books that a few of our guests have authored. Hopefully, this will give the encouragement and hope that we all need in this season. And in one final announcement before I introduce this episode, well, in a great but unforeseen turn of events, I moved across the country this summer with our tech producer. Thankfully, we're married, so it makes that a little less weird. But that does mean that Sam and I will be socially distantly recording from here on out. So hang with us as we work out the sound bugs while giving you the most enriching podcast season yet. In this episode, we explore the question, what does healing look like politically and ideologically? And we are so fortunate to have a guest, Dr. Andrew DeCourt. He's the founding director of the Neighbor Love Movement in Ethiopia. And this episode is not to be missed. You will be challenged both in the way that you think and also in the way that you live, but in the most gentle and inviting of ways. You'll even leave feeling just encouraged and refreshed. So without further ado, let's jump in. So today we have a special guest. We are so excited to welcome Dr. Andrew DeCourt. He is the founding director of the Neighbor Love Movement, which works to inspire love, justice, and flourishing across boundaries in Ethiopia. Andrew holds a PhD in ethics from the University of Chicago and is the author of Bonhoeffer's New Beginning, Ethics After Devastation. He has served as a lecturer in ethics at Wheaton College, the Ethiopian Graduate School of Theology, and the University of Bonn in Germany. Andrew and his wife Lily have been married for 10 years, and they live in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Welcome, Andrew. And of course, well, we have known each other for a few decades, and it is a delight to have you back here and to hear more about what you are doing as we explore this topic of healing from kind of an ideological, political, and neighborly standpoint, which I don't know if there's, well, at least a time in our lifetime when this has been more relevant.
Thank you so much for your hospitality. I'm so delighted to be here with you.
Yeah, so excited to have you. You know, we're talking about healing in various forms. And as you know, right now, ideological sort of pain, political divides, as Kimberly noted, these seem to be on the rise in our world right now. So how would you define kind of this injury to begin with? I mean, is it even an injury, but how would you define the healing that needs to take place? What is it trying to heal?
Yeah. It's a complex question, but I think there's often a common root to ideological and political injury when we believe, when what we believe and how we organize our communities are driven by power, then ideological and political injury begin. Mm-hmm. On the ideological side, our religion and ideals start justifying privileging ourselves and diminishing others. And then we see trust broken and suspicion take root. And on the political side, our laws become unjust, or they get enforced in partial or oppressive ways, and we see injustice normalized and violence committed. And power is a zero-sum game. Either we get it or they get it. And this is really the logic of war, whether it's a cold war or a hot war. And thus we begin dividing ourselves into groups with us versus them mentalities, which we see increasingly today. We develop a blind loyalty to our group, whether it's defined by a flag, a language, a religious confession, a piece of land, or a skin color. And on the flip side, we develop suspicion of anyone who's other than us. Rather than seeing the other as a neighbor, we develop enemy images of the other to justify treating them as less or unrelated to ourselves. So the common good gets abandoned for winning and greatness. And soon enough, the other is seen as inherently dangerous or less than human. And we start using slurs and insults, like calling them a weed or a scumbag or dog or demon. And this becomes the basis of systemic injustices and mass violence, like we saw in American slavery, segregation, and the Rwandan genocide. And ironically, when we look at both of these societies in Rwanda and the United States, they were both overwhelmingly Christian by identity. But when love of power becomes stronger than love of neighbors, this corrupted love can become catastrophically destructive and injurious to the body politic, to the community that is shared in a society. So I think ideological and political injury are very, very real and extremely dangerous.
I mean, wow. So in thinking about American history in the context for most of our listeners, I have the sense that there is a belief that we have a difficult history, but it's mostly in the distant past. And then more modern things like the genocide in Rwanda that you mentioned, that we sort of have this mentality of like, well, that isn't really happening here. And even though we have a lot of political divides in the US now, I don't know that we see it really on that same scale. So do you think really just like the Democrat Republican divide, for example, is really that bad that it's really, you know, some sort of large injury that needs to be addressed? Or is this really just, I mean, people disagreeing as they've always done about a better way forward?
Again, it's a complex and important question. I think we live in a time of sensationalism and exaggeration. And so we need to be careful to avoid that. But we do see deep seeds of othering in our society. And again, I would define othering as seeing people as less or unrelated to ourselves. And the language that we've grown increasingly comfortable using, which is often insulting, deeply disrespectful, sometimes dehumanizing in public at the highest levels of power, is very, very troubling. Because if you look at the sociology of hatred and mass violence in a society, the common root again and again is this pattern of dehumanizing language and othering trends in social attitudes and human relationships. So just to say that's the thing of the past or it's not so serious, I think would be very careless.
Yeah, your language that you said, like the other becomes dangerous, like that, I hear that so much, not only, I mean, you know, in the big political realms, and which has long been standing in racial realities in our country, but just within families and within friend circles, like if you think differently or act differently around something, not in a harmful way, but just literally in a different way, you now become ideologically, you know, we can might say, or politically dangerous to me, even if, well, it seems to break down some sort of connection or conversation or love. And it feels very extreme as a felt experience in that regard. So with this idea of these enemy images, which, I mean, like I was just talking about, feels so close, like they feel so intimate. It's right across the table sometimes in family experiences. Like, what's some of your ideas about how we may like overcome some of these enemy images that we, you know, that are rooted both right now and long term?
Yes. I think this is a really hopeful question. We can actually overcome enemy images and rebuild and heal neighboring relationships. So the first suggestion I would have is being invited to love the enemy. Some people are simply waiting to hear the words, love your enemy. They want to be inspired that there's another, better, more hopeful possibility for relating to others and healing their community. And just a quick story, in 2018, I was in eastern Ethiopia on the border of Somalia, and I was invited to speak at City Hall to a large group of high school students. And just not far away in the region, in another city, there was an ethnic cleansing taking place where youth were going door to door and telling minorities, you need to get out of the city or we're going to destroy you. And in that message that I gave, I called these youth to love their enemies and unpack reasons why I think loving their enemies is a lifestyle that's worth living. And there was a young woman named Ferdosa who came up to me after that talk and said, Dr. Andrew, no one has ever told me to love my enemies before, but starting today, I will love my enemies and I'll teach others to love my enemies. And she grabbed my hand and raised it up like she was making a kind of covenant with me. And I saw that people like Ferdosa are looking to be invited to another way of life, not just as a kind of cheap morality, but as a way of life. I am someone who will love my enemy. And of course, this is deeply rooted in Christian, Islamic, democratic traditions. And I would say that our churches, our mosques, and other public platforms should be megaphones to the community, consistently offering this message, love your enemies. Another thing that I would say is encountering the other. We need to spend time with the other and see that they are human too, perhaps even beautiful and good. Then a few years ago, I was in a similar part of eastern Ethiopia, walking through a neighborhood, and this city is famous. It's called Harar. It's famous for its hospitality. And I literally walked down a random neighborhood door gate, knocked on the gate, and just saw if they would invite me in as a total and complete stranger. A woman came to the door, opened it, welcomed me in, and I spent the afternoon sitting with her husband named Abdi, who's a Muslim on the border of Somalia, you know, one of the sworn enemies of the United States, or at least that's how we picture the relationship. And what does Abdi do? He offers me food and tea, and we sit and talk for hours. And he told me that he loves Allah because Allah has created each one of us equal and wills justice for all of us. And I left Abdi's home with this incredible sense of reverence and hospitality and awe that someone that I could have seen as an enemy, a Muslim in the Horn of Africa near Somalia, had welcomed me into his home as a complete stranger and embraced me with love. So I think these kinds of encounters with the other can shatter these enemy images. And again, churches, mosques, and other public platforms should be cultivating spaces where this kind of encounter can happen. Something else that I'd mention just quickly is awareness of myself. And this is hard. I too am hungry for power. I too can be dishonest and unjust. It's not really an us versus them situation we're in. It's an us and us situation. And this step, you know, requires honesty and courage and hope. But I'd also say it requires personal healing, because some of the resentment and anger and aggression I'm projecting onto that enemy image is really my own dissatisfaction with myself, my own disappointment, my own hatred of myself. And so awareness of myself and cultivating healing is extremely important in overcoming enemy images. And that's where I think like spiritual direction can be an incredibly important relationship that produces peace in society. And I'd also just mention art and media. We need to literally see others through new lenses. So this could be documentaries. This could be talk shows. For example, there's a documentary called As We Forgive from 2008 that explores how the healing process happened in Rwanda after the genocide. And it follows women who literally forgave the murderers of their families. Incredibly powerful. And you literally see courageous women seeing their enemies not as enemies anymore, but as neighbors and as human beings and healing their communities. So people need to be invited to love their enemies. They need to encounter their enemies. We need new awareness of ourselves. And I think the arts and media can be extremely powerful in healing these enemy images.
Yeah. I mean, I've two things I love. I mean, I loved a lot of what you said, but two things I think really stand out as important. And I'm glad you named one is just the felt sense of injury by the person who is doing the othering, right? That yes. they often feel a slight pushed aside, something they perceive some sort of injury. And so they feel like they're in some way like a victim of this. And they yes. have, I think, like a skewed sense of justice about, well, then what follows is justified in some way because of how I feel or my perception. And the second thing that that really sticks out to me is just the self-awareness component. And we talk a lot about that because it, like you said, it's such a big part of the spiritual direction process and what people go through. But it's one of my favorite lines in this area is from Richard Rohr, no surprise, but he says, it's always outside the self. It's always outside the self that the self seeks to fix the self's problems. I thought about it. It's top of mind because I thought about it in my own life in the past week. And I was like, oh crap, I'm doing that again. Yeah, projecting outward. So I feel like that maxim has seemed so true. And I love the idea of keeping self-awareness in front of us every step of the way and having the humility to go, even in our sort of strongest convictions. For me, I think a component is even in my strongest convictions as an Enneagram one, or just as a person who feels things intensely, to go, I really, really think I'm right. I know what I know. I know. And I want to leave a little sliver that I might not be right. But there's something I'm not seeing. It's not the end of the story. My perception isn't all encompassing. So I think it's really good to bring that to the forefront.
Wow. This is, yeah. And it really, you know, Andrew, what you're saying really flies in the face. And we're going to go into this in our further into our season about healing and, you know, in family settings and all that, as we kind of explore healing through this whole season. But it really flies in the face of, I'm just, as you were talking, I'm not only thinking of my own community and walking down the street, you know, and seeing people in stores. I'm thinking of Facebook groups that I'm on or something and listening to people, like just the vile frustration and hatred. And I feel like hatred is a strong word because I don't know if they would put that on, but from the outside listening, you know, as they talk about family members who disagree with them and how do I cut these people out of my life and how do I distance, and everything is a movement towards distancing the very person or the very kind of people they say are othering. So this is it's a hard thing to get our mind around, right? I'm going to distance myself from you because you are othering other people. And so you are toxic to me. And what you say, like, I love the hopefulness in your enemy images, because for that person, their enemy image is that other person whose ideology says, you know, like, who says that your ideology is so far away from mine because you other. So it gives me permission to other. There's such a lack of awareness, kind of what you're talking about, I guess.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Andrew, in your experience, I'm curious, because you literally work and live in this space. So in your experience, are there steps? Are there sort of like must-haves in this process? I mean, I know that there's a lot that we could be doing and should be thinking about, the self-examination, right attitudes and all of that. But are there certain concrete steps that you're like, every time you have healing on this neighbor level, this ideological or political level, you have to have these components? What would you say to that question?
Yeah, I think that healing is personal to every individual and to every context. So there's not a one size that fits all. But I do think that there are common steps in the face of ideological and political injury that can cultivate healing. Sure. I think the first is naming the hurt. There's often deep humiliation, anger, grief, as you mentioned, a sense of victimization and loss of power that has festered inside of an individual or community, and that needs to be named. What is it that's causing the hurt, and how is that manifesting itself in our emotions? So rather than being emotionally unaware and just exploding on others, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's in person or whether it's on the communal and political level, what are those hurts? The second thing that I would mention is describing our understanding of the narrative and who's responsible. Again, this gets to the question of victimization. How do we think that we got here? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, our understanding of the past is deeply important for our engagement with the present and the future. And here it's important to remember that we only have one side of the story. We may see ourselves as the lone victim who has been oppressed, marginalized, mistreated by whoever we see as the other side. But of course, they're going to have another perspective on this story. And here we get into like that maxim, the danger of the single story. But what is our understanding of the narrative? Who do we see as responsible? And how might that be an incomplete picture of what's taken place? Are we willing to listen to the other side's picture of what happened? How did we get here? Who's responsible? The third thing that I'd mention is owning our own responsibility. We are rarely fully innocent. We love to picture ourselves as this. You know, angels and demons are somehow easier to deal with than complex, fallible human beings.
Where I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. You know, sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong, sometimes I get a piece of it right, sometimes I get a piece of it wrong. Can I say, yes, I am also involved in this conflict, in this creation of enemies, in this injury? And again, I'd say that there's hope in admitting our own responsibility, because it means we are also agents. We're not simply victims. We are agents. Those that we consider as others are also agents. And we can consider what is our piece in the responsibility for this conflict that has started. And I would say that another step towards healing is expressing our desire for new relationship with the other. This needs to be named. And this can be extremely, extremely simple, but extremely powerful. We want relationship with you. You matter to me. You matter to us. We want to live in a relationship, not simply avoid one another or dominate one another. We want to be neighbors. Neighbors doesn't mean that we're the same. Neighbors doesn't mean that we always agree. Neighbors doesn't mean that we don't ever have tension between us, but it means that we're together and we matter to each other. So I'd say we have to name the hurt. What is going on in this conflict? We need to describe our understanding of the narrative and who's responsible. How did we get here? And how do we maybe have a partial or biased interpretation of the conflict? We need to own our own responsibility. We too are agents, and no one is totally innocent, rarely at least. And no one is totally guilty, or rarely at least. And then we need to express our desire for new relationship with the other, for this neighboring healing to be possible, I think.
Wow. You know, what really strikes me in that is two things as I listen. And one is just the humanizing. I mean, we hear the word dehumanizing all the time, but like this humanizing thing, like when you said, like, I want to be in relationship with you. Like, it pierces through so much of, okay, whatever you believe, whatever your story, however you think we got here, right? Whatever your responsibility is in getting us here, whatever mine is, I want to connect with you because of your value as a human being on this earth, because you are my neighbor. That really, it brings a humanizing factor and, it cuts through, kind of like I think of Christ doing, you know, when I read the Gospels, like he just kind of cuts through so much of the noise and just brings something that's like right through. Here it is. And it doesn't make it all go away, but it sort of, it brings clarity. so that we can make our way and find our way. And this other thing, on your third thing, you said, you know, owning our responsibility, what is ours? Because then we can, you know, we can actually do something about that piece. The irony of that, because you started talking about power at the beginning, you know, is that when we're so driven by power, we're really out of control, right? We don't have power over ourselves. And this third piece, you're talking about this, you know, when we own our own responsibility, and I just, you know, in my awareness, I'm able to take responsibility for what I've done and what is my part in this. I'm now gaining back power, appropriate power, right? And I actually have the control that I'm meant to have, and I can exercise it appropriately. And then I don't, I wonder if then it lessens my need to control or power over others, because I have appropriate control and power over what I can and what I should have power over. So,
yeah. Kimberly, can I just say one thing there really quick? This is an extremely profound insight that you're having. You know, a lot of people think when they admit their role in what is wrong, that they're humiliating themselves and losing power. And I think you're naming the exact opposite. When we can take responsibility for our part in the conflict, we're actually becoming more powerful agents. And rather than humiliating ourselves, we're actually showing our strength. We're not out of control. We're actually centered, stable, and strong. And I think your perspective could really help as we're dealing with, well, if I admit this, then I become weak. And you're saying it's the opposite. No, admitting it is a sign of strength. But that's extremely important.
Yeah, I think of, I can't think of an exact instance, but I have the image of like someone on the playground calling someone else, you know, like you're short or something like that. And the person saying, yeah, you're right, I am. You know, and kind of like being able to just own it. Like it doesn't have to be this defeating thing, or like you were wrong, or you were kind of arrogant and that, and go, yeah, I think I was. I guess I was kind of arrogant when I said that. And how freeing that would be for someone like me to be able to say and not have the reaction of like, oh my gosh, someone thinks I'm arrogant. I have to prove them wrong or come up with a defense why that's not the case. But to just, to own your part, that makes intuitive sense to me. I don't think I've heard it that said that way before, but that makes intuitive sense to me. Mm. That it's a powerful thing to do.
You know, can I ask one last question as we kind of move into hearing more about your work, Andrew? I didn't send you this question, so I apologize ahead of time. But I'm just thinking as we're talking about this, because this is more plays into the work that I do personally and some of the teaching and the writing that I do. But I'm wondering what part self-love plays in the ability to grow in other love, in your perspective, like if you have any thoughts on that.
Love that question.
Yes, I think self-love is extremely important. Jesus, Moses, Paul, they said, love your neighbor as yourself. And if you see yourself as worthless, as disconnected, as less than others, then there's going to be a deficit or an empty tank to love others. But if you see yourself as precious, as embraced, as full of good gifts, then there is a fullness to be able to share with others without a sense of loss when you give, when you sacrifice, when you expend energy and time and attention. So I think loving ourselves is extremely important for other love. It shouldn't be seen as narcissistic. It shouldn't be seen as self-indulgent. It should be rather seen as the goodness and the life-giving well out of which love for the other overflows. So this should not be ignored. How am I loving myself and seeing myself as valuable? And oftentimes the ways that we beat ourselves up, blame ourselves, pigeonhole ourselves, punish ourselves can be the patterns that we use against others as well. So working on our own healing can be essential to working on healed relationships with neighbors, with communities, with ethnic groups, with political parties. So absolutely, neighbor love and self-love are inseparable.
I love that.
Thanks for, I think that's an important word to just like Christian community, because it's interesting how often that idea gets pushed back. Well, can you tell us more about how the idea, how your neighbor love movement is just working to foster healing in Ethiopia, and just tell us a little more about this and give us some inspiration and hope.
Yes, thank you. So the neighbor love movement is working in Ethiopia to promote seeing and treating other people as neighbors. And we see a neighbor as someone who has precious value to us. So that's why our logo has a diamond in it with spokes around it. It's meant to symbolize that the other has precious value. And when we can see this value, we have a compass for how to live our lives. And we promote a 46-word covenant that simply says, "Today I covenant to love my neighbor as myself. Every woman, man, and child is my neighbor across every boundary and identity. I choose to see and treat my neighbor with love, justice, and practical compassion. Today I'm an ambassador of neighbor love." And being an ambassador of neighbor love means choosing to embody 7 practices. And we really believe that that neighbor love begins in our bodies and the ways that we practice being embodied persons. So these 7 practices start with my eyes. I will literally see you as my neighbor. My ears. I will open my ears to listen to you even when we disagree. My mouth, I will speak to you with truth and respect. Even when we disagree, I will ask you to forgive me when I wrong you. My hands, I will use my power to help you instead of harming you. My feet, I really love this one. I will move my feet to get outside of my own circle and to walk with people who are different than me. These could be outsiders. These could be the enemies that we're talking about. I'll move my body with my feet to get closer to you rather than farther away. My heart, I choose to make my heart a place that embraces your joy and your pain rather than harboring envy and curses and desire for revenge. And my mind, my brain, I choose to live a unified life. I'm going to hold together my values and my lifestyle, my beliefs and practices. I'm not going to say, "Hey, I'm a follower of Jesus, but I'm going to hate my enemy." So the neighbor love movement promotes this covenant and these 7 practices through deep relationship building in Ethiopia. We've developed a strong network, for example, with the Attorney General of Ethiopia, the Minister of Women, Children, and Youth in Ethiopia, the Minister of Peace in Ethiopia, but all kinds of different Christian and Muslim leaders, all kinds of youth leaders, activists for women's well-being and women's dignity, people working with street children. We have launch events at Ethiopia's universities. Right now we're working with the Ministry of Science and Higher Education in Ethiopia to try to get our video content about seeing and treating other people as neighbors in every university in Ethiopia. We're really hoping that that works out. We're also developing groundbreaking content. So we've written and published the first book in an Ethiopian language on loving your neighbor. Again, I go back to that story with Ferdosa in Eastern Ethiopia. No one's ever told me to love my enemies before. We've written this book and we want to share it with young people so that they can have a new vision for how to live. And our dream is to open a permanent neighbor love embassy in Addis, which would serve as the hub of our movement with offices, event space, media studio, and rooms for hospitality. And, you know, something that we think about is that it's ironic that we have hospitals to help our bodies when they're sick, and we have gyms to help our bodies be strong through exercise. But we have few, if any, public centers that are helping us work on, okay, how do we heal prejudice? How do we heal hate? How do we bring our community back together and see one another as neighbors and work that muscle of forgiveness, of peacemaking? And that's exactly what we want to try to do. And so another tool that we've developed is called the Ambassador's Body Checkup, the ABC. And I love it. It's just meant to be a simple tool to look at my body and how am I practicing neighbor love with my body. For example, let me just share it with you really quick. It's super simple.
Please.
Eyes, who do I overlook or see as an outsider or enemy? Pause and reflect, starting today, recommit to seeing others as precious neighbors. Or for the ears, what words, issues, or people make me shut down and stop listening? And again, it's meant to be a moment to pause and to make a list and to recommit to listening with patience, or the mouth. What words do I use that insult or offend others? When was the last time that I asked for forgiveness when I made a mistake? My hands. When am I tempted to point my fingers or raise my hands against others? My heart. Which individuals or groups do I disagree with and resent? Does their happiness make me sad, or does their pain make me happy? Or my feet. When was the last time that I stepped out of my comfort zone to meet an outsider or enemy on their own ground? And for the brain, where do my beliefs and values contradict the way that I'm actually living with my behavior? So this is meant to be a simple tool to look at, how am I doing with making my body the starting point, the practice of peace and healing in my relationships, in my society. So the Neighbor Love Movement is trying to promote these types of visions and practices and tools with Ethiopian youth and emerging leaders who are going to define the future of a society that many fear is on the brink of a civil war or a situation like Rwanda. So we're working with as much passion and commitment and creativity as we can.
Wow, it's really powerful. And great to have such a concrete practice or practices. I love our podcast, and I love what we talk about when we don't often have like a concrete takeaway like that, something to actually implement, and it's some guidance to do it. So I think it's wonderful that you have that already. Is your covenant and some of these practices, are these on your website as well?
They are, yeah. You can go to nlmglobal.org, and the covenant is there. The practices are there. We're going to get this ambassador's body checkup on the website soon, and you can actually sign the covenant there, and we'll send you a monthly email with a reminder to renew your covenant. We're not going to flood your inbox, but we'll send you a very short, simple monthly email saying, thank you for signing the Neighbor Love Covenant. We invite you to pause and renew it today.
That's great.
Wow.
So I have a question that just came to mind. I'm hoping I meant to ask it, but I mean, hearing you describe this, it's really inspiring, hopeful. I think we need so much more of that right now. And I'm thinking about this, and I'm like, wow, you're like living this. And I'm like, hey, Andrew probably also has times that are difficult for him, times that he needs these messages too. So, you know, in your work as someone who does this full time, where's that growing edge for you, or where's one of those growing edges for you? What's hard about what you're doing, even though you have these principles ahead of you in your work?
Yes, it's always hard. And this is why we use the language of practice. It's work that we do every day. At the end of April and the beginning of May, I received about 60 death threats and hate messages for some of the bridges that I was trying to build between polarized communities in Ethiopia. That's extremely disturbing on a personal level. A death threat is really a kind of psychological terrorism. Of course, for my wife, that's very disturbing as well. And so I think the kind of cutting edge of my growth is really leaning into the love of my enemies. And a practice that I've been working on is actively blessing every person who sends me a hate message saying, we're going to throw you off a bridge. We're going to run you over with our car. We're going to butcher every part of your body with knives, and saying, I'm pausing right now and blessing that person in the name of Jesus. Let them experience healing and peace and hope in their life. And if I ever meet them, may I have the composure to speak words of grace and hope and justice. So that's an area where I'm growing personally in composure and strength to love.
Yeah, I have the image of a muscle, you know, and some of the work I've done, they tried with some practices where you tried to, you know, start small with forgiveness, start small with love. Yes. And if you can do it on that small scale, that's when you can grow up and really be able to sort of flex that in a good way, to apply it to these things, like such an extreme thing, like a death threat that would be so disturbing. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Thank you for your vulnerability and honesty and around that is so appreciated, and kind of pales in comparison to some of the, and I know you're not looking to say that. It just it gives some perspective, you know, and in the love, we all have our growing edges, right? And where it is hard for us to use that muscle and to extend that grace and to, you know, actively bless that other person. I so much appreciate your creativity and all that, your whole heart and self that you bring to this and that you've brought to us today too. I just, as we're finishing up, is there anything else you want to tell us about, like where listeners could find you or your work or anything else? And we will put everything in the show notes as well, links and all that to everything you say. But if there's anything else that would be helpful and serve people or they could find your work.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much again for your hospitality. I'd like to invite everybody who's listening to become an ambassador of Neighbor Love. You don't need money, internet, technology to do it. We need our bodies, and we can all work these muscles of love towards others. You can find me on Facebook. I'm really active there, Andrew DeCourt. You can also find the Neighbor Love Movement on Facebook. All of our content is published in Ethiopian languages, but also in English. That's at Balinjeraye, B-A-L-I-N-J-E-R-A-Y-E, Balinjeraye. You can find our platforms on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Telegram. My personal website is andrew-decourt.com. I write a weekly newsletter. I'd love to add to that the reflections on faith and ethics. And again, our Neighbor Love website is nlmglobal.org, and you can sign the covenant there. And we would love to send you a monthly reminder to renew that commitment that could literally heal community and create a more hopeful future for all of us.
That's great. We'll put all of those links in our show notes for sure for anyone who needs them and didn't catch them in the recording. But thank you. Thank you for what you bring. Even when we got on the call, you know, we asked guests to spend some quiet time before the call, try to sort of pause with intentionality. And it's just so obvious that you're embodying this work for yourself as well and doing the practice, like you said. So thank you for bringing that to the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew.
I'm so grateful for your hospitality, Sam and Kimberly. Thanks for welcoming me. I'm grateful to grow in friendship and partnership together.
Amen.
Spiritual Director Podcast. We are so delighted that you are with us, and it helps us tremendously if you head over to iTunes and rate us and review us there. We also invite you to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss any more of this question of exploring what does healing look like in 2020. In the next two episodes, you can expect more about this societal healing. We're going to explore what does healing racial trauma look like, and what does it look like to heal within our faith communities during this time. So, see you next time.